Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode number 388. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois, just north of Chicago, south of Wisconsin. We like it that way. I'm here with a good friend, Lane Tipton. Lane Tipton teaches systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's also the pastor of Trinity OPC in Easton, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Lane. It's great to have you again.
Thanks, Camden. As always, it's great to be here.
Yeah, and we are continuing our series in Voss's Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments, as we do once a month. We try to hit the schedule on the first Friday of the month if we can, and we march on through the book. Today we're on page 88, and we're hopefully going to get all the way to page 90, talking about ethical elements existent during the period in the patriarchal period, and we've been looking at Revelation in the patriarchal period, but now we come to a key teaching on the ethical elements here, particularly with the covenant sign of circumcision given to Abraham, and that is a massive topic, and we're going to treat Voss's three pages on that thoroughly, but as we do so, we're also going to expand things so that we bring in some other material and connect some dots that Voss is going to make and hopefully deliver a pretty thorough theology of circumcision, connect it to baptism, and connect it to covenant theology overall. But before we get into that subject, we do need to mention a couple things. The first, of course, is our donation page at reformedforum.org/donate. We encourage you to visit us there because it helps us immensely. We love volunteering and recording and producing all of our programs. We deliver them to people around the world, and thousands of people are downloading the programs all over the world. We get the stats in the different countries and all that, and it's mind-blowing to one extent, but we would like to expand and do more to get some help, perhaps with audio editing. So the first thing, if you have someone of interest or somebody would like to help out, let us know, especially somebody who might have Adobe Audition or Pro Tools experience. We'd like to talk and see if such a thing might be possible. Now, to make such a thing possible, we need you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. There you can sign up for a one-time gift or a monthly gift. If you're able to support us, of course, it's a secondary or tertiary or quaternary, I guess is the right term, concern. But if you're supporting your church and you still have an overwhelming desire to help us, we encourage you, visit us online today, reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. We want to thank everybody who already does so, and we encourage those of you who've been listening for a while and those who like what we do to help us out. The other thing you can find online is information about our 2015 Theology Conference. Last year, in October, we had a wonderful first inaugural conference, and Lane was there with Scott Oliphant, and this year Lane's coming back, and we're welcoming as a plenary speaker, Dr. Richard Gaffin, and we're going to be speaking about the Spirit and the Church. This is October 16th through 18th, once again in Grays Lake, Illinois, so it's just north of O'Hare Airport, not too far. And visit us online, reformedforum.org/conference for all the information that you need. We're going to have more information shortly in terms of conference address topics and that sort of thing. But for now, you can find all the accommodations. You can get an early bird rate. I was just looking at conference rates for other conferences that have been advertising recently for conferences in the fall. And I think we're about half the price of any of the others, but we're going to give you about four times as much theological content. So why don't you visit us online? You can register. You can come to our conference October 16th through 18th. We'd love to have you. It's a small-scale conference, 100 positions available, and then we're sold out. The reason we do that is because we like to keep things small so that we can have a lot of interaction with between the participants and the people that are attending. Lane, what was your experience like last year, and are you looking forward to this year?
I had a wonderful time. Not only did I enjoy the opportunity to make a couple of presentations and breakout sessions and things like that, but I particularly enjoyed the time of discussion that followed the presentations, both mine, yours, Dr. Oliphant's, and others, And the time that we had with the people who attended over meals and just over cups of coffee was a wonderfully encouraging time. So I'm already getting excited about the prospect of our upcoming conference. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Oh, me too. Yeah, it was unlike anything else I've participated in. So I'm looking forward to having everyone back. I hope everyone that came last year is wanting to come back this year. I know we've had strong support. A lot of people signed up right away as soon as they found out about the registration again. But we want all those of you out there who are on the fence or wondering whether or not you want to come. You absolutely do. If you can make it, it's affordable. There's a good place to stay. We got a good rate on a nice hotel down the street. It's not super fancy, but it's very clean and updated. And we're just going to have a good time talking about the Spirit and the church. So it's going to be very, very rich material.
Yeah, and let me say this. If people out there are not very familiar with Richard Gaffin, Dr. Gaffin, I would assume they are. But if not, for that group, let me say that whatever Gaffin does by himself on its own terms will be very much worth the price and very much worth coming for the entire conference. He will do a job that's just unparalleled. And so I'm thrilled he's coming and will bring my laptop and take copious notes.
Absolutely. So early bird rate, $99 for the full thing, $79 if you only want to come to the main conference on Saturday. There's still one spot for our VIP dinner package if you want to come. It's $250, but you get a spectacular dinner. It's worth every cent.
People, I enjoyed that.
One
too,
man
Kevin.
Was weeping after dinner. I'm not joking. He knows who he is. He had such a good dinner. The taste of his steak made him weep. And you likewise can have a moving experience if you visit us online at reformforum.org/conference. There's one spot left for that.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we had a good time. That's great. Today we're talking about circumcision, and you know, there's an awful lot here when we talk about the patriarchal period and God's administration of covenants, first with, well, there's been many covenants, one with Adam, but of course when we talk about the covenant of grace, we talk about Abraham as a particular covenantal figurehead there. What is Voss getting into now? Why do you think he puts this ethical elements section on page 88, right in the midst of this revelation in the patriarchal period chapter?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it gets to a deep structure in Voss's theology as a whole, and here it is. Voss is wanting to integrate the indicative of God's promises of redemption on the one side with the imperative of Spirit-wrought faith that appropriates that indicative and obeys the Lord by faith on the other side. In other words, he's wanting us to recognize this, that we've talked about election, the objectivity of redemption, the supernaturalistic character of the redemption that God has promised to Abraham, and now the focus turns to the ethical element, and what Voss means by that is, we're going to see, is very, very important, because the ethical element is going to be the way that it's going to bring into view not merely obedience to an external norm, but it's going to bring into view the way the indicative, the way the gospel, the way the covenantal promises are appropriated by Spirit-wrought faith. And he's even going to talk about the sign and seal of that in circumcision. And so this is really indicative imperative. This is going to be nuclear or basic to Voss's understanding of the structure of the covenant of grace. The indicative, the facts and promises of God, the fact character, the accomplished promissory character of God's redemptive revelation culminating in Christ, and then the imperative brings into view the Spirit-wrought appropriation of those promises by faith in obedience. And you really, I don't think get much deeper than that when it comes to Voss's theology of the covenant of grace.
No, and Voss begins right off the bat speaking about Abraham and his uniqueness in covenant mm-hmm. history. Abraham's life was conducted on a high ethical plane, he writes, and then he says even the modern school agrees with this. Only they explain this from a later ethicizing treatment of the ancient stories by writers imbued with the prophetic spirit. Mm. But in Voss's understanding, and in the conservative and biblical and appropriate reading of the text, Abraham has a unique place in covenant history as this ethical figure. And by that, we don't just mean that he you know, tries to think through doing the best thing in every scenario, but he, as a covenant figure, has that unique position between indicative and imperative as a representative. Yeah. He sticks out among others, doesn't he?
Yeah, he stands out in a very unique way. And I don't know if we'll get to this in an extended treatment, because I don't think Voss is going to really work it over. But Genesis 22, I think.
Yeah, it's in the next section. I'm sure we'll get to that next month with Isaac.
Yeah, very much worth talking about. But at this point here, Genesis 18, 17 through 19 is a key text. And it might be worth – do you have a text with you, Camden?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. Would you read that, Genesis 18, 17 through 19, and then we can comment on it, because Voss sees a very significant ethical dimension, ethical principle enshrined in Genesis 18, 17 through 19.
Mm-hmm. It says, "The Lord said, 'Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him, to keep the way of the Lord, by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised to him.'"
Yeah, that is kind of an encapsulation of everything we looked at in election, objectivity, and supernaturalism. So Genesis 18, 17 is bringing into view and kind of cataloging and summarizing the full range of the indicative, that the Lord has called Abraham, will make him into a great nation, the nations will be blessed through him. So everything we talked about the full range of that indicative as it moves toward Pentecost, as the Lord is destroying Babel and building a new nation of people who love him and serve him, all of that is the context now for what Abraham is to do. And what Abraham is to do is to command his children to keep the way of the Lord, to do righteousness and justice. And then here's what Voss says: so that on that ethical activity was suspended the fulfillment of the promise, to the end that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. And so what's really interesting here is this, that the indicative of redemptive promise is not operating apart from a spirit-wrought imperative by which Abraham, by faith, obeys the Lord, teaches his children, and in that way, through that spirit-gifted faith and obedience, working by love, through that way, the Lord will bring upon Abraham what he has spoken of him. And that's an amazing integration of the indicative, the promises of God, the redemptive reality secured by God on the one side, and the role that Abraham, by spirit-gifted faith, will play as he obeys, as he teaches, and as the Lord fulfills his promises through him. So that the indicative is not operative apart from the imperative, and compliance with the imperative is a means through which God is going to realize all of his promises to Abraham. It's an incredibly robust integration of the indicative and the imperative as Abraham becomes a kind of template for not only what the way believers are going to appropriate the gospel. But when we get to Genesis 22, I think he becomes a kind of prophetic type and sign of the coming Messiah.
Right. Voss really places ethics in here right at the essence of religion, but not in a sense that it's meritorious or somehow earns or warrants God's gift, but as a means by which they would appropriate them. He says, ethics are not, however, represented as independent of religion, much less as the sole content of religion, but they are the product of religion. And he brings up Genesis 17 to emphasize this, the chapter before what we just read, which is a key covenant text, which contains the classic expression, I am El Shaddai, walk before me, then thou shalt be blameless. What is the walking before El Shaddai illustrative of, or what does it demonstrate?
It's beautiful is what it is. He's saying something like this. The idea of ethics is independent of religion. That's old-fashioned natural law theory. That's paganism. The idea that ethics is some kind of separate, self-grounded thing that is natural, or it is the sole content of religion. Voss is bringing into view the naturalizing tendency of liberalism. The liberals want ethics to be the essence of the Christian religion, but they want it to be independent of redemption, independent of eschatology, independent of the supernaturalistic covenantal revelation of God. And so what Voss is saying is that Genesis 17:1 forms a template for situating the imperatives of the gospel, or the ethical dimension of the Christian life. And here's what it is. Walking before Jehovah, walking before the Lord, pictures the constant presence of Jehovah to his mind as walking behind him and supervising him, and the divine approval furnishes the motive for obedience. Let me put it in different language. What lies at the core of obedience to the Lord is a communion bond that has been redemptively wrought by God himself. So Abraham's walking before the Lord is part and parcel of what it means for Abraham to have been united by spirit-wrought faith to the coming Messiah and to find in God his blessedness and reward, Genesis 15:1. So that what's shaping the conduct of Abraham is not simply the idea of God as a moral ruler or someone who gives commandments that are to be obeyed, but there is a kind of bilateral, reciprocal fellowship between friend and friend. Yes, it is the Lord God Almighty. Yes, it is the Creator and the Redeemer into whom Abraham has been brought into covenant, but he is to walk with the Lord in that special affection that is wrought in a covenantal bond of communion. And I think Voss is saying, if you want to locate ethics properly, you have to locate ethics in a covenantal, spirit-wrought, redemptive communion bond with the Lord. And Abraham is prototypical.
Yeah, right. And that connects with the El Shaddai name, that God is all-powerful, almighty. He can do all things. And then Voss mentions that that all-powerful God here, as you say, is not merely a moral ruler, but specifically the thought of El Shaddai, the one who fills Abraham's life with miraculous grace. Thus, so there's a connection there, thus morality is put on a redemptive basis and inspired by the principle of faith. Right. I think that's a pretty powerful statement, because it demonstrates that the morality here is connected to what God is doing in and through his people, even though everything he's doing with them is purely by grace alone,
right,
and obtained by faith, but even that faith is a gift itself.
Right, so that what you get here in an embryonic form in terms of the history of special revelation is something like this. Abraham has been engrafted into the Messiah by Spirit-wrought faith. He is a participant not in Babel, which has fallen, but in a new nation, a redemptive kingdom wrought by the Lord and the Lord's Messiah. And he is to now live as befits his status in this kingdom, in communion with the Lord of this kingdom, and as he has been united to the promised coming Messiah. So that you can get something like this. This is, prior to Pentecost, this is the adumbration of resurrection life, of walking in newness of redemptive life, participating in a kingdom that is going to come and ultimately destroy every vestige of Babel and raise a people up where that communion bond with God is perfected. That's the essence of miraculous grace. That is the essence of redemption, and that is the substance of which faith lays hold. And so it really is. I mean, Vasta isn't pushing it quite that hard, but in terms of the development of what we've gotten in biblical theology, and in terms of a biblical theology, you're really getting kind of the prototypical expression of the Christian life here, and it's amazing what he does here. And it's really easy, Camden, for us or others to read over this quickly and miss almost the Copernican importance of this. In terms of Voss saying no to liberalism and saying yes to a religion of supernaturalistic covenantal religion, it's quite basic and quite really exhilarating, mm-hmm, to see it.
Right, and that's what brings us to circumcision, because we have a picture, a visible demonstration that is a sign and a seal, a means of grace, and a covenant sign, that is, that demonstrates all of what Voss has just laid out on page 88. It demonstrates the engrafting into Christ through, that's why also it's a sign of covenant membership, but it also demonstrates in a visceral and a very bloody way what it takes, or what the cost is, or what needs to be done to be brought into that body. So how then does circumcision in all of those senses really encapsulate this ethical character of the Old Testament into a ritual, a covenantal ceremony?
Well, this is where I find Voss to be quite brilliant. He discusses circumcision now under the ethical character of Old Testament religion. Now, what does that mean? Let's just review really quickly, just to be sure that we don't miss this. When Voss talks about the ethical character of Old Testament religion, the imperative, what has he already said? Well, he said this. He said that the imperative or the ethic of Old Testament religion is walking by faith, is walking in a communion bond with the Lord, by the power of the Spirit in union with the promised Messiah. You could summarize it that way. And so what circumcision is going to symbolize and signify as a sign of the covenant of grace in its old covenant form is life in communion bond with God. What does life in a communion bond with the Lord look like? Well, it's going to bring into view both the indicatives of the promises of God, in other words, election, objectivity, supernaturalism, union with the coming Messiah, centrally situated in terms of the sign and seal of circumcision. But at the same time, it's a kind of summons to appropriate that indicative by a faith that walks with the Lord, by a faith that humbles itself before the Lord, by a faith that pursues the Lord in a way that exhibits the righteousness and holiness that is proper in a covenant relation. And so what Voss is doing here kind of ingeniously is he's saying that the sign and seal of circumcision is going to encapsulate both the promises of God, that what God makes to his people. So the priority is going to be on God promising, God condescending, God securing redemption. But at the same time, circumcision is going to carry with it an obligation.
Yeah.
An obligation to be holy before the Lord, so that the essence of the covenant, both in terms of promise and obligation, is present in what circumcision signifies and seals. It's amazing. It's really, really, I think, an insightful formulation on Voss's part.
Now, Voss recognizes that many other people groups engaged in circumcision. It was common at the time. Earlier scholars argued that that must have been because they had interacted with the Israelites. But more recent scholarship has demonstrated that that's probably not the case, that circumcision has been common throughout the ancient Near East, but also in America, the native peoples, and many others engaged in this activity. Why did God choose that to be his particular sign, to use that as a very graphic sign of his covenantal, of this covenantal ethical character?
Yeah, Voss makes the point that it was what God does is he takes a sign that in certain cultures has a sense of cultic purity or just physical purity, and he imbues that sign with a wholly new religious significance. So when the sign is being applied to those who are outside of Israel, there could be a cultic significance, a purification significance, a hygienic significance. And what Voss says is that the Lord takes this up, bloody sacrifice, bloody ritual that it is, and he utilizes it in order to convey something of the essence of the ethical and spiritual truth of the covenant of grace. And so on the one side, it's going to bring into view the need for cleansing through blood sacrifice, the need for cleansing through the shedding of blood. It's a bloody sign. And so in this way, it's going to be a sign that can anticipate what happens when someone undergoes a trial by knife ordeal. What is it? It's a form of judgment. It's a form of curse. It's going to be a sign that Paul can apply. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but Paul can apply to the cross of Christ and call it the circumcision of Christ in Colossians 2:11 and 12. Mm-hmm. So on the one side, it can be a sign of kind of malediction and curse that is going to be fulfilled vicariously by the Messiah. On the other side, it can be a summons to be pure and to be holy and to be set apart to walk with the Lord. So it can be a sign, when appropriated by the Lord, that brings into view both the promise of the indicative on the one side and the fulfillment of that indicative through faith in the life experience of believer, both the one who receives the spiritual reality signified and then who walks in a manner worthy of that, of what that sign signifies. So it's the Lord taking a sign that's used outside of Israel and imbuing it or filling it with uniquely covenantal content.
Yeah, and there are even differences in the way that the Israelites administer the covenant via God's command that demonstrates that it's sealing and signifying something different than in its other uses. The original concept, it might have been a tribal badge. Mm-hmm. So Voss mentions it would not have been applied or administered in infancy, but when a grown-up young man was for the first time admitted into full tribal rites. For others, it has to do with some sort of commitment that you might make to the deity via self-mutilation. Even in others, it might have some sort of connection to the sexual activity, and therefore you would expect it to be administered at the time of sexual maturity or just before. Mm-hmm. But for the Israelites, they administered circumcision to infants on the eighth day. What significance does that have, once again, for this ethical character?
Yeah, well, it's this, that in God's intention, this sacrament should subserve the teaching of ethical and spiritual truth. And he says this. He says there is a movement from what is more or less implicit to what is more or less explicit. And it's this, that it begins to be clear that this is used, that the sign of circumcision is going to function to show the need for a circumcision of the heart, that is, for a purification in the Messiah that brings about a transformation, a renovation, a justification. That is, it's going to come in a phrase to become a sign and seal of spirit-gifted union with the Messiah and all of the benefits of the covenant of grace. That's where this is going to drive. And what Voss says is this, that you get the external performance in Genesis 17, and he says, as you're moving through Deuteronomy, he says Moses in Deuteronomy 10:16 and 36 begins to exhort the people to circumcise the foreskin of their hearts. And the Lord, your God, will circumcise your heart to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. And he says these are kind of encapsulated in Jeremiah 4:4. Take away the foreskin of your hearts, you men of Judah, lest your circumcision be uncircumcision. Now, what is he getting at? It's this. It's that circumcision is going to signify and seal all that's presented by way of election, objectivity, supernaturalism, in a phrase, union with the coming Messiah, forged by the Spirit, obtained by Spirit-gifted faith. All of that is now being brought into view as that which fundamentally affects a redemptive change in those who receive it. Mm. So that the circumcision that promises life and signifies life as you are led to the Messiah by faith is going to bring about a fundamental change, redemptive conversion in those who receive it. And so the sign is a sign and seal of spirit-gifted union with the Messiah and all that it involves ethically, all that it involves in terms of life experience is bound up in the significance of circumcision, because as it develops throughout the Old Testament, there's this exhortation to circumcise the heart, and so
yeah. So the problem goes down to the core, but also the fact that it's administered to infants on the eighth day, you know, the first day of the next week, basically signifies that this is a problem from the start. So yes. It's not just done to adults who have accrued personal sin, you know, in their own lifetime. This is a problem with fallen human nature.
Yes.
And therefore it needs a radical change, which happens through a fundamental change, a cutting off of the sinful aspect. And that's not merely just in the physical foreskin. It has to be a circumcision of the heart. So the outward external sign is a sign of a much greater, deeper spiritual need and a much greater spiritual redemption and reality that is given to those and through those that have faith.
That's so well said, Camden. And we need to remember this, and this is an important thing to recall, that this spiritual significance of circumcision is not something that itself develops. The spiritual significance of circumcision is given to Abraham prior to these texts that we're looking at in Deuteronomy and Jeremiah 4. That is, there is an essential, de facto, inherent spiritual significance to circumcision as that sign and seal is given to infants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, I think, an important point. You could say this, that the sign and seal of circumcision, and could we look at this, Romans 4:11?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's look at this. If you could read that, we can comment on it.
Yeah, Romans 4, right at, I'll start at 9. Is this blessing then only for the circumcised, or also for the uncircumcised? For we say that faith was counted to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it counted to him? Was it before or after he had been circumcised? It was not after, but before he was circumcised, he received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the father of all who believe without being circumcised, so that righteousness would be counted to them as well, and to make him the father of the circumcised, who are not merely circumcised, but who also walk in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised.
Yeah, now that Voss is picking up on that, and this is really critical. Here's what's so important to note, that circumcision is not first and foremost a sign of faith per se. It is a sign of the righteousness that Abraham had by faith while uncircumcised. What is the righteousness that Abraham had? It was the righteousness that accrues by virtue of spirit-wrought union with the Messiah. It is the same essential righteousness that believers in union with Christ have. What's the difference? Abraham was in union with the promised Messiah. Believers are in union with the Messiah who has been incarnated, crucified, raised, and ascended to sit at the right hand of God. It's a difference that is redemptive historical in that you move from promise to fulfillment, but the essential righteousness, the fundamental righteousness that Abraham had, is no different from the righteousness that believers in union with the exalted Christ have. And so what starts to appear here is this, that circumcision is a sign and seal of what accrues to those who are united by faith to the promised, now come, Messiah, to Christ. Now, why is that important? Well, here's why it's important. He applied the sign and seal of the righteousness that was his by faith to his infant offspring who had not yet had opportunity to believe or failed to believe. What's the significance of that? Well, I think we can put it this way. Abraham and the sign of circumcision being applied to the infant offspring implies this, that there is no objection to the application of that sign of the righteousness that Abraham had by faith. There is no objection that you can make to the application of that sign to infants in the Old Covenant that you cannot also make with regard to the application of baptism to infants in the New Covenant. Think of it this way. Abraham had not yet received the land promise, right? He had not yet received the promised land. The land was his in the mode of promise. There was a sense in which Abraham was still an alien and a pilgrim and a stranger, and he had not yet entered into the land that God had promised him. It was his in the mode of promise and not fulfillment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, the church, with regard to the future inheritance, it is ours by promise, but it is not yet ours by sight. We have not yet entered into it. And the point is this. Abraham could have said, If circumcision is a sign and seal of a righteousness by faith, and my infancy does not yet exhibit faith, and if circumcision is a sign and seal of an inheritance to come with regard to land, if it has those things in view, I should wait to apply that sign until I see evidence of faith. You see, he didn't do that. What did he do? He applied the sign. Why? Well, he applied it because God has ordained that circumcision, like baptism, be a sign and seal of what God promises to believers and their seed.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus isn't on what a human being does to exhibit fidelity to the Lord. It's what the Lord has already promised, and it's the mode of operation by which God claims a people for himself out of the world. So the bottom line here is that circumcision clearly is a sign and seal of the same righteousness that belongs to the church in the new covenant that's symbolized by baptism, signified by baptism. And that sign and seal of a righteousness that is by faith is applied to an infant seed in both testaments, in both covenantal, both old and new covenant.
Right. And Colossians 2, 11 through 13 would demonstrate the connection between those two signs, and the sign we have now with water baptism being an even greater and broader sign, because it's not bloody, but it can also be applied to all people, not merely males, but it's more inclusive in that sense. But I think one of the difficult points for many people, especially of the creative Baptist persuasion, is that there's this fundamental difference of understanding in terms of what these signs are. Are they signs in the direction of man to God, a sort of a declaration of a thing that we do? I would kind of go back to the circumcision for the self mutilation, where the young man might mutilate himself as a sign to God that he's committed unto the tribe. It's a sign from man to God. Or is the sign a sign of God to man, of what God has promised, and that he would give that to those who walk in his ways, and to those who are his people, his covenant community, the people who are purchased by his own blood? I think that very basic difference is all the difference in the world, and we start to see how what God is doing with Abraham lines up with what he's doing with us, and the inextricable link that we find between the two in Romans 4. It makes so much more sense when we do see that circumcision, and now also we should also say baptism, is a sign of the righteousness that we have by faith. It is not first a sign of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that just reorients everything. That was very helpful for me years ago.
It's very helpful. And in an interview you did with Dr. Gaffin,
yeah,
and
you
with
were there.
Me, Gaffin, I'd turn our listeners to listen to Gaffin on that.
We have
Gaffin,
a video of it online, one of our few, but if you want to see him speaking on the subject, he treats this in great detail.
He does. And mm-hmm. and just to put the point on it, the sign of circumcision and the sign of baptism together are first and foremost signs and seals of a gracious, sovereign indicative of election, of supernaturalism, and of the objectivity of redemption in the Messiah by the power and promise of God.
Yeah.
And that needs to be given all the weight that we can give it in order properly to situate the reality signified and sealed at the deepest level of both sacraments. And so, Camden, I think you're right on the money. And I think Voss is very helpful there in saying that the bottom line here is that no matter what we say about the indicative, no matter what we say about the promises of the gospel, we have to recognize this, that human response is always a function of the sovereign condescension and redemptive power of God.
Mm.
There's that. That's the key. And I think once that starts to settle in, we can start to move away from the idea of baptism or circumcision, but a particular baptism signifying first and foremost something I am doing.
You're right. Yeah. So we should also say then that it, maybe the terms we could come up with new terms and call ourselves indicative Baptists versus imperative Baptists.
Hey, there you go. That might be a way to go. We could, because we would want to turn around and bring the imperative in only as it's flowing from the sovereignty of the indicative.
Amen. And that brings us back to the beginning of page 88.
Yeah, it does.
You know, where the ethical character does flow out, but it is given through the Lord and his redemptive work. And so Abraham's ethics, insofar as they're done out of faith, are given to him and flow forth from what God has done in his life.
Right.
And the
wonderful
sign,
circle there.
Exactly. And the sign signifies that same type of reality.
Right. So that if it signifies and seals union with Christ by the Spirit, then what we say is that whatever the imperative is will flow out of that Spirit-wrought union in an irreversible way, right? Mm-hmm. The indicative doesn't flow out of something we do. It flows out of what God has done to join us to the Messiah. And then the imperative, the Christian life, flows out of that Spirit-forged union. And that places the emphasis precisely where the paedobaptists have placed it, on the activity and agency and promises of God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's helpful, Cameron.
It makes all the difference.
It really does.
Yeah. Well, next month, I should say, we'll get into the patriarch Isaac, which begins at the very, very bottom of page 90. And we'll work through him and see if we'll touch on Jacob, but we'll see how far we get. Jacob is a big topic because Voss will treat election, the Bethel dream vision there, wrestling at Peniel. It's a great summer camp, I hear. you can hear our episode on the Peniel issue in the archives. A great conversation on what happened there. So we'll see how far we get, but I think this has been an important episode for us to discuss circumcision, and I hope listeners will understand. Taking three pages, you can see, though, how foundational much of this material can be, and will help us to understand many other sections and portions of covenant history. So Voss, as it is, very dense, understandable, but we love speaking through and talking about Voss and helping everyone to come to fuller grips with this magnum opus, really, from one of the greats, the founder and father of Reformed Biblical Theology.
I hope we don't frustrate listeners by taking so much time, but it's better, in my view, to really try to work through this and gain clarity on just how important a section is for the development of theology, rather than to just brush through it and say, well, if it's only three pages, we can move through it quickly. If we spend the proper time getting clarity where we need clarity on deep, important structural issues, it will repay us a thousandfold as we grow as theologians. And so I hope it'll prove fruitful if we can work patiently and slowly through some of these texts, because they really are worth our careful, undivided time and attention.
Right, and my introduction to Voss was the very opposite. I picked up biblical theology because it was on a reading list, and I read it front to back over the course of maybe a couple weeks. And it was useful, but I didn't understand much of it, and I would have served myself much better by reading it carefully and slowly and with help and with people to talk to. So we're trying to model what we think is a good approach, but it's slow goings. But I did a lot of reading in quantity back when I was new to theology, Reformed theology especially, and I would have been much better served by a slow and careful quality reading. So trying to rectify some of that and help the listeners out there to maybe even learn from my own personal mistakes. So
hey, likewise. That's same here. And so I hope the slow patient route will prove useful.
Amen. Well, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll be able to find information about all of our programs as well as how to get in touch with us. You can tweet us at Reformed Forum. It's a good way to get a hold of us, or send us an email if it's more detailed at mail@reformedforum.org. Once again, please visit us at reformedforum.org/conference for information about our Fall Theology Conference, October 16th through 18th at Grays Lake, Illinois, just north of O'Hare Airport in Chicago. It's going to be a great time. We really would like to have you here, and we'd like to meet you if we haven't met you already and spend time with you over the weekend. So visit us online. We want to thank everybody so much for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.